From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A lot of the time when you're talking about the Constitution, you come upon the argument of whether it's a dead or a living document, set in stone with an original intent or designed to be adapted as the country changes. Well, in his series for PBS on the Constitution, Peter Sagal tried to stay away from that debate. If you frame it that way, he says, what you often end up with is a liberal perspective or a conservative perspective. And the history of our relationship with the Constitution is far more complicated than that. Today in the program, Peter Sagal is joining us as his series comes to an end this week. We'll talk about what he's learned along the way. Sagal says the reason the Constitution works is because people engage in it and use it and, he says, believe in it. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When PBS embarked on this project to explore the way the U.S. Constitution works in the 21st century, they could have gotten a journalist to host the program, you know, someone like Nina Totenberg, someone like that who's covered the Supreme Court, spends a lot of time talking to scholars, or they could have gotten a scholar to do it too. Lord knows there are plenty of them. Instead, the producers of the program chose Peter Sagal, the host of NPR's weekly quiz program, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Now, Peter himself has said the real gift that he brought to this project was a kind of basic ignorance about the Constitution, something we probably all have. The series began a few weeks ago. It's wrapping up on PBS stations around the country this week. And the idea was to have Peter go around the country and ask real questions about how a document that's almost 225 years old is working in the 21st century, or this question, how the Constitution is lived today. Peter Sagal is joining us today to talk about what he's learned over this process, and we invite you to join us as well if you have questions or comments. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Peter Sagal, of course, has been the host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me since 1998. He's also an award-winning playwright, author of the book of Vice. Constitution USA airs tonight on KUED Channel 7 and PBS stations around the country. And we'll give you more details about that as we go along. Peter's joining us today from WBEZ in Chicago. And Peter, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be back with you, Doug. And I have to say, listening to your introduction, I, too, am shocked and appalled that I was asked to host this documentary. Whose idea was that? Honestly.
What is that
considering
about?
Nina Totenberg, I think, agrees with you that somebody like Nina Totenberg should have been hosting this. I have a good friend who is an actual lawyer and is looking at me like, why you? You? I did 3 years in law school, and what do I get? He said.
But isn't that the basic idea? I mean, the brilliance of it in many ways is that you're probably more well-versed in the Constitution than most of us. But that was, the charm of the piece, and I think kind of the conceit, wasn't it, that you were going around asking legitimate questions about this stuff?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that one of the things that's happened is that the law, and particularly constitutional law, has become sort of like a priesthood. And the metaphor or analogy to religion comes up a lot when you talk about the Constitution, i.e. that there's this elect group of adepts, lawyers, constitutional scholars, particularly those lawyers who deal with constitutional issues, who talk about a lot of things and understand how it works. And the rest of us just have to take it on faith, to extend the metaphor. And there's a certain kind of contempt, I think, a well-meaning contempt that comes out of the academy, the legal academy, the Supreme Court bar, for the rest of us. We just don't know how it works. We don't know about precedent or stare decisis. I can't even say it. We don't understand which are the key cases and how the Supreme Court works. And, you know, just like, you know, Milton wanted to justify God's ways to man, we wanted to justify or explain how this all works in a way that someone, well, like me, could understand it. Yeah. Because most people don't know how this stuff works. And that's a shame, because by this stuff, I don't mean this abstruse, recondite, you know, area of inquiry like advanced, you know, statistics. Mm-hmm. I mean life in these United States, how we are governed, what rights we have, where we got these rights, how they're defended, who defends them. How we establish them, how we lose them in the cases where we've lost them. Mm. And it's really important stuff. And we wanted to do a little bit to bridge that gap between, you know, the temple, if you will. And, you know, temple was a phrase they used to use for the law courts in London.
Yeah.
And the great unwashed, in which I include myself. I'm not very washed.
Well, what do you think most Americans do, in fact, know about the Constitution? And I'm not talking about like one of those Jay Leno skits where he walks
around. Yeah, I know.
Around, you know.
Although it's you can fall down that trap. We went on a parade route in Evanston, Illinois last 4th of July, and we said to people, well, what do you know about the Constitution? They said, oh, I love it. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that's not in the Constitution.
No.
Most people think of the Constitution, if they probably will name the First Amendment. They'll talk about you know, the right to free speech or the right to religion, the right to assemble and redress. You know, now we're getting a little introduced. Mm-hmm. A lot of people know about the Second Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
More people talk about the Fourth Amendment, although they talk about it in very broad and vague terms, that there's a right to privacy and a right to be left alone, I think, to quote some justice.
Mm-hmm.
And then it falls off. There are certain activists out there who are very strong feelings about the Ninth and Tenth Amendments. And then there are Article I guys, enumerated power guys, who get very interested in the limited powers of the federal government, usually because they want to limit those powers further. But most people believe in the Constitution more than they understand it. And again, to use religion as an analogy, it's sort of imagine if you know someone who's, say, a committed Christian, but he or she doesn't really know the Bible. He couldn't recite Acts or Romans or Corinthians for you. But they tell you, well, you know, we're supposed to be good to each other and there's a heaven and we're all made in God's image. It's sort of general ideas about what they believe is in the Bible. Mm-hmm. That's sort of how people relate to the Constitution. They may not be able to cite it or know its clauses, but they'll say it means that we're a nation of laws and that we have elections and the elections are binding until the next election and no one's above the law. And these are all good and true things. I came to appreciate that, the fact that there's this widespread belief in a kind of civic religion that really is what binds us together.
Well, isn't this, I mean, this is kind of one of the takeaways, at least it was for me, this idea of belief in the document is a pretty critical thing. I mean, that seems to be in some ways how it functions.
Well, that's the essential thing. And that's the funny thing is that, you know, again, you start from this idea, if you're a snob like me, like, well, the Constitution is very complicated and the mechanism of the Constitution is very complicated. And the lawyers and the academics who are figuring all this stuff out, they're taking care of it and making sure the government runs.
Yeah.
That's dead wrong. The reason the country works, the reason we haven't had an armed rebellion, say, in, well, about 150 years, is because of that basic level of civic belief. The fact that all of us, you in Utah, me in Chicago, everybody between us, no matter how, I mean, you know, take the difference between where you are in Utah and where I am in Illinois. As politically different as you can imagine, I'm in a very blue city, you're in a very red state, although I know you're in a kind of a little blue dot in that red state. Very different ideas, especially with the Mormon history in Utah, very different ideas about the relation of the church life to civic life. Great. We have a lot of differences. But what binds us together is this basic belief in the Constitution, this basic belief that whatever our differences, we're going to work them out through the same mechanisms of government. And that's why it works, because all of us agree to abide by it on a daily level, not because of some brilliant scholar coming up with some brilliant insight in his study.
You know, one thing I found interesting is you've been talking about, I guess over time you've been able to, the course of the project, you've been able to kind of distill down why it is you figure it works. And so, yeah, belief is part of it. It's interesting you've also given these two kind of basic reasons why you figure it, in terms of structure, why it worked. And one of them is it was short.
Yes.
That's a big
deal.
As
am I, so I feel a certain, you know, bond with the Constitution. We're both brief. Yeah, it's very short. And what's interesting is in tonight's episode, we go to Iceland, it's now been defeated, but they were trying to create a new constitution after their economy and pretty much their entire state and government fell apart during the financial crisis.
Right.
And one of the things about the constitution they wrote, which they did with a lot of inspiration from our constitution and a lot of crowdsourcing, they put it all on Twitter while they were doing it and Facebooked it, is it's really long.
Yeah.
Because you get a bunch of guys in a room, or gals in this case too, and you say, okay, I want this in the Constitution. I want a constitutional guarantee for animal rights, say, which is in there. And somebody else says, well, I want a constitutional guarantee for environmental protection. Well, great. Okay, we'll put both those things in. The next thing you know, you've got a really long constitution. And the problem with that is not with you guys who've written it, but with your posterity.
Right.
Things change. People change. Maybe the next generation is going to want to treat the environment differently or treat animals differently or do anything else differently than what you, as the writer of the Constitution, said they should. Our founders didn't make that mistake. They left most stuff up to us, their posterity. And we have taken that freedom throughout our more than two centuries of American history, and we've done really different things. We have changed our minds as history has progressed. And because they gave us that flexibility, by simply not writing that much stuff into it, it succeeded.
You write about how the Constitution was not meant to really resolve things or settle arguments, that the idea is to allow us as a country to argue a point without killing each other.
Right.
And Akhil Amar, who the professor, Yale law professor, prominently figured throughout the series, he says this is a big deal in terms of human history. He calls this the hinge of human history, in fact.
It's quite a phrase.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. And a number of people, having heard Akhil Reed Amar say that and me repeat it in conversations like this, say, come on, you know, what about... Somebody suggested, the 500 theses that Luther nailed to the wall or the discovery of fire or various other technological things.
Yeah.
Why this? Why the ratification of the Constitution as like the single most important thing that's ever happened in human history? And I think that Akhil's got a case. Think of it this way. From the moment that we, you know, stopped being traveling bands of hunter-gatherers whenever and started settling down into agricultural settlements. I'm going back a ways here.
Yeah.
How many? 5,000, 10,000 years ago?
Yeah.
The rise of civilization. Human politics was a matter of force. Religious, family hierarchies using force to determine what people would do.
Might
makes right. Yeah. And my joke has been, if you want to see what human history was like prior to the Constitution, watch Game of Thrones. You know, George R. R. Martin, who wrote the books upon which it's based, told me that if he told you what really happened in the Middle Ages in terms of politics and war, we wouldn't believe it. It's so savage. So basically, government by and for the powerful, and 99% of the people who have ever lived had no rights whatsoever and were lucky if they made it to the old age of 40.
Yeah.
Okay? Now, 1787, an entire continent from Georgia to Maine votes on how they will govern themselves. And they determine that through a structure, they will govern themselves democratically, and they will stick to that structure no matter what happens. That's amazing. And here's the crazy thing about it. It worked. Not only has our country survived with a couple of, a little inconveniences, a little brouhahas, a little hurly-burlies here and there, but that has become the model for human civilization. We went from autocracy, power, hierarchy, misery, war, and death to democracy. Gradually, but increasingly. That's now the model for civilization. Mm. Is it democratic? Who voted? Who got to vote? That's pretty serious. My apologies to Mr. Luther, but religious schisms had happened before. My apologies to the guy who invented fire, but technological advances had happened before. But something like that, a single moment of huge political change from, roughly speaking, bad to good, had never happened before.
Were you surprised that you didn't really encounter, or maybe you did, and I didn't see it in the series so far. Did you encounter anyone who said, now, it hasn't really worked? Because it seems like... Is that right?
Yeah, well, I mean, there are people who feel that in their particular instance, the Constitution failed them.
Right.
For example, Michael Cristofaro, who was featured, I think, in it was either last week's episode or the one before that, whose parents' home was bulldozed because of the Kelo versus New London decision, which basically allowed the government to seize and destroy his parents' home in the hope of it being developed into some sort of more profitable thing.
Yeah. It's now a field now.
It's now an empty, it's a field of weeds in New London, Connecticut. But there are other people who didn't make it onto the final film who interviewed who feel that the Constitution itself is out of date.
Right.
That it's too tough to change. It has these ridiculous late 18th century structures which were silly at the time, like the Electoral College. Mm. That it creates an incredibly cumbersome government that, as we have seen in recent years, can grind to a complete halt. They point out, as many people do, that when new democracies occur, as they have in the world since the founding of our country, they tend to use a very different model. There are very few other presidential models where the executive and the legislative are separated. Most countries have parliamentary systems where the head of state, the head of government is also the head of the legislature, because you know what? More stuff happens. And these are valid criticisms. Yet, I think that the success of America as the longest-lasting democracy in the world, the most vibrant democracy in the world, the economic powerhouse of the world, is kind of hard to argue with. And when you start asking counterfactuals, well, will we have done even better if we had a parliamentary system or if we had direct election of presidents? Well, you know, then you're talking about how many, you know, founders could dance on the head of a pin.
Right. I wanted to ask you about how you saw your role. There's a clip I want to play. I think this is from episode 2. This is Albert Snyder.
Yes.
And I think I'll have you set this up for us, if you would, Albert Snyder. Of course, he's the father of a soldier killed in Iraq, Matthew Snyder. And I think that the clip I want to play, and we'll get to that, is your exchange with him. Because you ask a very difficult question, and he responds in kind, and he sort of leaves you hanging there for a moment, which I think is sort of a powerful moment in the series so far. But set this up for us, if you would.
Okay. Al Snyder is the father, he would tell you, of a young man who was killed in Iraq around 2005. And at that time, the Westboro Baptist Church, the people that everybody loves to hate, this fringe religious group, it's basically one family in Wichita, Kansas. Everybody's heard of them by now.
Yeah.
They're very homophobic, and they like to picket soldiers' funerals. They say that it's because God is punishing us by having our soldiers killed because we tolerate homosexuality. I think they just like attention, whatever.
Yeah.
They showed up. They picketed in a very vile way the funeral of Corporal Matthew Snyder. Al Snyder got very upset. Al Snyder sued them under a state law in Maryland, claiming emotional distress. He won a lot of money, millions of dollars. The Westboro Baptist appealed. It went to the Supreme Court. The reason it's a significant case is because the Supreme Court ruled 8-1 that they overturned the judgment, and they basically said, under the First Amendment, you have the right to be extremely offensive in a public place, no matter how much emotional distress you may cause on any individual around you. You have that right under the First Amendment.
Let's play this clip. This is episode 2, actually, of the series Constitution USA.
My son died for the Constitution, but I can't believe that our forefathers meant something like this to be free speech.
What I'm thinking of is where to draw the line, because obviously you'd agree that if I express an opinion about anything, it could hurt somebody.
I don't see it as a line, but I see it as a case-by-case situation.
Yeah.
You have to use common sense. I mean, if we can do or say anything to anyone, anywhere, anytime, what kind of civilization are we going to be living in?
Aren't we making our freedom of speech subjective if we allow the level of hurt experienced by another person to determine your rights to speak?
You come back and you tell me that when it happens to your child.
Okay. I hope I never have to do that.
I hope you don't. I hope nobody has to do it.
That was a really powerful moment in the show, I have to say. And it made me wonder about how you saw your role, because there you are. In a very delicate situation, pushing back a bit on a very important question related to the Constitution. What are the boundaries? What is the limit? And there's a bit of a catch there. I mean, there's that pause where you sort of it seems like you're not entirely sure how to respond.
Well, I wasn't. Yeah. I was kind of surprised that they ended up, the editors, that is, keeping that in the film, because it was, shall we say, not a moment where I felt like I was at my witty, you know, snappish best. But it was very genuine.
Yeah.
And my job, to answer your question, Doug, is that I felt my job was to ask difficult questions in as nice a way as I could. But I wanted to challenge people, because what's the point of hearing somebody say something without challenging them a little bit so that they have to justify their views? And I did it to everyone. When I was sitting and talking to Chris and Sandy Perry, who want to get married, who were suing into the Supreme Court for that right, they're a same-sex couple, obviously. I challenge them. Where in the Constitution does it say anything about marriage? Why shouldn't you be forced to accept the result of a Democratic election, i.e. the passage of Prop 8 in California?
Right.
You know, just because that's elections work. You lost. I'm sorry. And I really did feel like that was my role. And we got more, and I think more revealing answers. And it was interesting in that segment that Al's answer was really interesting, because I said to him, don't you agree that, you know, you shouldn't make free speech subjective to someone else or subject to someone else's feelings, i.e. I have a right to free speech until you decide that I'm hurting your feelings.
Right.
And he didn't respond, you know, substantively to my point, like saying, well, yeah, this is how you do it, and this is the rule, and this is the test, as the Supreme Court might say. He said, let's hear you say that when it happens to you.
Right.
I.e., let's see how far your logic goes. You know, where's your logic now, Moses, as a terrible thing happens to you? And of course, it raises the question, not begs the question. I'm a jerk about this. It raises the question of where do you need the law? And you need the law where emotions begin to cloud judgment. Because contrary to, I think, what Al says, common sense is easy. Common sense helps us, you know. Common sense is what tells us when we're walking down the street not to scream obscenities at people, or not to use the classic example, yelling fire falsely in a crowded theater. That's common sense. Where we need the law is when common sense is unreliable, where common sense tells me I'm going to walk over to that guy holding up a God hates fags sign at my son's funeral and punch him in the face.
Yeah.
Because that's a common sense reaction to that situation. And that's when we require the law.
Let me ask you about Kristen Perry and Sandy Steer.
They're, sure.
It's in the section, it sort of, there was a, I thought this was another powerful moment in the film. You're talking about the 14th Amendment. You describe it as this big toolbox, you know, providing the yeah. means for expanding equality and protecting rights and enhancing liberty, all that kind of stuff. And the question, you know, you raised, does it solve every problem? No. Does it, you know, it's a framework. It's this process of give and take. And then there's this moment where you're talking to Kristen and Sandy, and you're talking to them about, well, you ask this question, and they talk about how they can live with it, even if it doesn't work out in their favor. And I want to play this this clip because, and have you talk about it, because I thought it was a really, I don't know, interesting and honest, kind of sad moment in some way, which seemed to express something bigger about us, that sometimes it works, sometimes it really doesn't. But you live with it, seemed to be kind
right.
of the takeaway. Here it is, another clip from the Constitution USA.
Let's say, because I know your case is being appealed and will be in this front of the Supreme Court, and let's say that they rule against you, that they find no constitutional right to same-sex marriage. Would you accept that?
Well, we would have to live with it.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't agree with it.
Yeah.
But we would live with it. I think what you do is you accept the life you've been given.
Right.
And the life we've been given is we don't get to be married. I've done that my entire life already.
Not every country has a constitution. I feel like, you know, fortunate to live in a country that does have one.
Right.
And I feel like I have a great deal of faith in it.
Despite all the things that people do and don't agree upon, the one thing that we all have in common is the Constitution. And it's the one place we can all go to find out, you know, how to solve problems or how we're connected.
Wasn't that a graceful way to put it? I thought.
Was.
Just in terms of, because it isn't right now working for them. And yet they still have an incredible amount of trust and faith in it. I thought that
well,
was powerful.
Well, that's the great thing. And again, I keep coming back to that, you know, again and again and again. This isn't in my insight, but people say the most important election we had in America was not for our first president, but for our second.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the loser accepted his loss and the winner took office.
Right.
And we're all living with it. You know, we just had a presidential election. And I think about, 49% of the country has to live with the results, even though they didn't want it.
Mm.
And I'm pretty sure it was reversed in the prior three presidential elections. And that's part of what I was talking about, that faith, that we understand that even if things don't go our way, if we've exhausted our legal constitutional resources to try to get our way, we're going to live with the result, because that's part of the social compact, that we are, in fact, a government of laws. So if the Supreme Court decides to reverse the federal district court and then the appeals court verdict in Prop 8, the case now known as Hollingsworth v. Perry,
right,
and Chris and Sandy don't have a right to be married in California, I think that's an unlikely result, but be that as it may,
yeah,
they can do other things. They can move to Washington State. They can start, you know, organizing for another proposition and another next election to rechange the state Supreme Court. They can do a lot of things. But they will accept it. And by doing that, they are going to be proving the value of the constitutional system.
NPR's Peter Sagal is with us, host of Constitution USA, which concludes tonight on PBS stations around the country. It's at 8 o'clock on KUED Channel 7. You should check your local listings for times where you happen to be. Other episodes, by the way, are also available online. For links and information, you can go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Peter Sagal, is joining us to talk about the U.S. Constitution. This week, PBS is airing the last installment of Peter's series on the Constitution. Maybe you've been watching it. Peter is riding around the country on a red, white, and blue Harley, exploring how the Constitution works in the 21st century, how it's lived today. You can join us if you like, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Were you much of a motorcycle rider before this?
Well, that's a funny story. I was when I was a much younger man, back in my teens and 20s. And like a lot of guys who are no longer in their teens and 20s, I gave it up when I got married and had kids. It seemed like the responsible thing to do. And when they contacted me, and when we were working together, we had this idea of a road trip, and somebody said, oh, Peter, you used to ride motorcycles. I know. We'll put you in a customized Harley and ride around the country that way.
Yeah.
And I'm like, great. Which one's the throttle again? And so I had to take a refresher course and renew my license, which was tricky. There's a shot in the very first episode where I get on the motorcycle and ride it out of the shop. And that was literally the first time I'd ever been on that particular motorcycle. And when I did ride, this was back in the 80s, and there were sort of smaller Japanese motorcycles. Sport bikes tended to be my thing. So now I'm on. Now 20 years later, I'm on a 800-pound Harley Davidson trying to ride it through an aperture 20 feet in front of me. And I ride off camera, and if the camera had panned, you would have seen me almost hitting the damn door and ending this whole documentary road trip long before it began.
I got nervous for you when you were riding around New York City.
Yeah, that was a little scary.
Yeah.
But, you know, actually, the thing about New York City traffic, it doesn't go very fast.
Right.
The scariest thing, there is a shot, and it's just sort of an interstitial shot. It's me riding in front of the Dallas skyline. We were traveling through Dallas to the airport, and the producer said, I used to live in Dallas. There's a great shot, elevated freeway. Let's get up there. So we pulled over. They opened up the camera van, so the guy was leaning out. And I'm trying to ride in 65-mile-an-hour freeway traffic in Texas with a camera van next to me, and all these Texans who were actually driving 85 miles an hour and wondering why this damned motorcycle is so slow and kept cutting me off. That's when you came really close to seeing the death of a public radio host on film.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Let's take a call. Adam is with us in Cedar City. Adam, welcome.
Hey, good day. I first wanted to say how much I admire each of you doing your regular day jobs. Both of your shows are very enjoyable to me, and I thank you for that.
Thank you.
And I wanted to make an observation. You were talking about how in America things are decided by democracy or by a matter of law. And I wanted to point out that our Supreme Court, in actuality, is making decisions on law in a democratic forum, because you seldom have a unanimous Supreme Court decision.
That's true. And you know, I said democratically or as a matter of law. And, of course, by saying that, I threw a blanket over all the Supreme Court decisions that have changed our society. But somebody said something. It was Akhil Reed Amar. It's almost always Akhil Reed Amar who said the really interesting thing. He has that gift.
Yeah.
Is that Supreme Court decisions, even the ones that we think of as being sort of world-changing judicial activism, for better or for worse, say Brown v. Board or Loving v. Virginia, the miscegenation case, they tend to actually reflect a democratic sensibility. I won't say a majority necessarily, but I'll say when the people are ready for it, is how he put it, the Supreme Court will often establish a right or change the law. And that was certainly true of Brown v. Board. Think about it this way. Brown v. Board reversed the decision. This is, of course, the desegregation case, the famous one that ended segregation.
Yeah.
It reversed a case called Plessy v. Ferguson from 1896, in which the Supreme Court said, oh, you know what? Having separate rail cars for colored people, as I used to say, and white people is perfectly fine. Mm. Separate but equal. Fine. Now imagine if in 1896 America, a profoundly institutionally racist country, the Supreme Court had come the other way and they had said, you know what? Actually, the segregation thing, unconstitutional. Under the 14th Amendment, blacks and whites have the right to be in the same place at the same time. Go. What would have happened? Would the country have accepted it? Absolutely not. To go into the racist, you know, late 19th century South and say, oh, by the way, you have to go in the same stores and the same facilities, there would have been another armed rebellion, right? Yeah. I mean, it's not a flattering thing to say about us, but it's true. Brown v. Board happened when enough, not by any means all, but enough people in America were ready for it to happen.
Right.
And then the struggle began anew to make it happen in all parts of the country. But it didn't come until we were ready. That can be moved forward, as it was in the case of Brown v. Board, by some brilliant judicial activism on the part of Thurgood Marshall and his associates in the legal community.
Right.
But it happened because the country evolved.
Yeah.
That also happened with Loving v. Virginia and many other cases. And if, in fact, the Supreme Court is going to declare a constitutional right to same-sex marriage, it will have happened because the country has, again, evolved. So there is democracy, even in those, you know, 5-4 judicial decisions. It is reflecting, often, the democratic sensibility of the country.
Wait, tell that story, if you would, of Anton Scalia talking to Ted Olson.
Yeah, it's a great story.
Yeah, it is.
And this is what happened. This was the argument during Hollingsworth v. Perry. And Scalia, who is a big skeptic on this, we know where he stands. He's
right.
Against this idea of reading a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. He makes the argument, which is not an argument to be dismissed, by the way, in any measure, that these things, these major societal things, whether or not we should have same-sex marriage, should be determined democratically.
Right.
As they often are, as they were in Washington State recently, i.e., if we want to change our society to allow same-sex people to get married, then by all means, let's vote on it and change it the same way we change our tax laws or we change our environmental laws or we change whatever else we're doing, or zoning, whatever else we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Why go to the courts to impose this change undemocratically? So Scalia is talking to Olson, who is arguing for the plaintiffs, for Chris Perry and her partner, as well as the other two plaintiffs. And Scalia questions him skeptically and says, so tell me something. If there's a constitutional right to same-sex marriage, when was that put into the Constitution? And Scalia's point is obviously there's nothing about marriage at all in the Constitution.
Yeah.
So you're telling me that something has been there that we didn't notice it? And Olson's response, which was kind of a Jewish thing to do, we answered a question with a question, even though neither of the people are Jewish in this exchange.
Right.
He said, well, when did desegregation written into the Constitution? When was the other rights that we've now recognized written into the Constitution? And Scalia responded by saying, well, you know, desegregation was written into the Constitution of the 14th Amendment. And he didn't go on to say what he presumably meant, which is that we just didn't know it until 1956. We pretended it wasn't there. And I think that this idea that there's this unchanging meaning of the Constitution and all we can do is do a better job of discerning it is both logically and historically wrong.
Mm.
That the people of America between the 14th Amendment and Brown v. Board knew exactly what the 14th Amendment said, and they all decided that it didn't mean you had to treat black people equally. It meant something else. And then we decided that, no, it does mean that, and started the long struggle of making it true. Similarly, we could decide with that same freedom and risk that it means that same-sex couples should have the right to get married just like opposite-sex couples, and then that decision will be binding. We've been doing that our whole history. There's no reason to stop now.
Mm. You interviewed Sandra Day O'Connor.
I did.
For the piece. And I'm wondering, we don't see a lot of that exchange, and I'm wondering what you thought about that. She can be pretty elusive.
She can
and be. Really cagey, I think, from time to time. I have to say, every time I listen to her interviewed, I get just frustrated because she's not going to give away.
Did you see Adam Liptak's review of her book in the New York Times?
No.
This is getting down in the weeds. Adam Liptak is the legal reporter for the New York Times. I think now he writes editorials about legal issues.
Yeah.
And he gave Sandra Day O'Connor's recent memoir and book the most scathing review. It must be literally the meanest thing that's ever been said to or about Sandra Day O'Connor in her entire public career. It's so disappointed. Yeah. And we had the same experience. Yeah. I know some of Sandra Day O'Connor's family. I know people who've worked with her. And everybody who's had personal experience with her says that she is opinionated. She is bold. She is, iconoclastic in her opinion. She's fascinating, deeply involved at her age in her 80s still. Great. Except when she's talking to the media. Except
right.
when you put a microphone in front of her face and a camera.
Yeah.
In which case, what you get, and excuse me, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, is you get bromides.
Totally.
Well, you know, the Constitution is our most important document.
Mm-hmm.
And we in the Supreme Court work very hard to get it right. And yes, we all get along and we take it. You know what one of the things we have to do is? We have to think about precedent. And you're like, oh, really?
Yeah.
And it's a little frustrating.
Yeah.
And I think maybe I know that Sandra Day O'Connor believes, because she's devoted her post-court career to this, to educating the public on the basics of the Constitution and Supreme Court jurisprudence. She started the program called iCivics, which we're a part of,
mm-hmm.
to try to help people get educated about these things. So maybe that's where she's coming from. She's like, you're a media person, therefore you're an idiot, and therefore I need to talk to you very slowly about basic stuff. There's a thing called the Supreme Court. It makes these judgments on difficult issues. This is how we do it. But honestly, I think that what she needs is she needs a plain speaking approach.
Yeah.
You know how Truman wrote his autobiography, and nobody really cared? And then a guy named Merle Miller went and interviewed him and did an oral history of what he really thought.
Yeah.
And it's awesome. Yeah. And I think someone needs to do that with Justice O'Connor.
Yeah, because you thought you'd go in and she'd start raising questions about Bush v. Gore and Roe v. Wade, and she wasn't having it.
Or something.
Yeah.
Or at least express an opinion about different ways the Constitution has been interpreted, originalism versus the living Constitution, anything. Or at least a story of what snack Nino Scalia likes to eat during during conference. Anything. Give me something. Justice O'Connor, please. We came a long way. But no, she's way too guarded and way too distrustful of these idiots with microphones.
Adam, thanks for the call. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Peter Sagal is with us, host of Constitution USA, which concludes tonight at 8 o'clock on KUED Channel 7. You should check your local listings if you're in another place. Other episodes are also available online. For links and more information, just go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with NPR's Peter Sagal. We're talking about his series on PBS, which is concluding this week, called Constitution USA. It's going to be on at 8 o'clock tonight on KUED Channel 7. You should check your local listings.
And by the way, I should say, Doug, for everybody who's been tuning in and thinking, oh my God, I can't believe I've missed it. It's the last episode. You can watch all of them online.
Yeah.
Through various methods. The simplest way is go on your computer to pbs.org and look for Constitution USA. I'm also told that Rokus now have a PBS On Demand function.
Yeah.
So you can sit there if you have a Roku or something like that and just dial it up. So really, you've lost nothing. You can go and see the whole thing from the beginning. You can make a whole like Rocky Horror type call and response ritual of it. Every Friday night at midnight, you can like, do all four episodes and shout things and throw toast at the screen. Really, there's so much yet to be done.
Are you proud of how it turned out?
I am. You know, it's funny. You get so much in the middle of this, and you and I'm sure many of your listeners know this, in the middle of a project, and sometimes you get so frustrated about how things are going and what didn't work, and you just want it to go better, and there's so many things you wanted to do, so many things that we did do that couldn't fit in the final project. For example, we spent an amazing afternoon at Little Rock Central High with Minnie Jean Brown Tricky, one of the Little Rock Nine, and we used like 7 minutes of that. Man, we could have done a whole hour with her.
Yeah.
But when all said and done and it starts being shown and people see it and they're responding to it with fresh eyes, not from the perspective of what we wanted to do and couldn't, what we tried but it didn't work, but just from what we did, all of a sudden you're like, oh yeah, this actually came out okay. This is good. People like it. People are getting so much of what we wanted them to get about the complexity and the specifics of constitutional thinking today. I'm actually very proud of it.
Well, I think what's refreshing about it too is that a lot of time it's distilled down, this conversation about what the Constitution means. It's often distilled down into a conservative perspective or a liberal perspective. You don't, frankly, spend a lot of time with gun rights. You don't spend a lot of time with abortion rights. And it doesn't seem to be broken down in this idea of original intent or anything like that. You're sort of moving beyond that.
Yeah, we are. And that was quite intentional. We started this, of course, more than 2 years ago. We started planning it. Yeah. And we really didn't want to touch on those two issues you mentioned, gun rights and abortion rights, because that's all anybody talks about when it comes to the Constitution. And believe me, as bright as I think I am, and I have no bounds to my ego, I got nothing new to say on either of those things you haven't heard before. So, and besides, those are, from the constitutional perspective, those are the gaudy baubles. That's where everybody looks. When all this other stuff is so much more important to how people's lives are actually lived. The Commerce Clause is so much more important to you than the Second Amendment. Most people don't know that. So we wanted to get into those things. In regard to the liberal and conservative thing, liberal and conservative arguments are the kind of thing that the Constitution is supposed to allow without, again, killing each other. We can have arguments between liberals and conservatives about the appropriate size of the welfare state, the appropriate level of taxation. Those aren't constitutional arguments, and we really wanted to what's the word in the filmmaking? Rack out, to pull back focus and say there's this whole machinery within which those relatively narrow arguments are happening. That's fascinating. That's got all this other stuff going on that completely transcends the usual boundaries of shouting people on cable news. I did not want to say anything on camera that you could hear either Chris Matthews or Bill O'Reilly shout at you on cable news. I wanted to get way beyond that. And I think people have responded to it. I've gotten really nice comments from liberals and conservatives. And some of those people are surprised, which I love.
Yeah. So there are a couple of really great characters in the piece. Akhil Reed Amar, you mentioned, is one. Rick Beeman is another.
Love him.
He's great. And I wanted to play another excerpt from the show. This is from, I think this is episode 4. This is the episode you'll see tonight. And you're asking this question, did the Founding Fathers really think the Constitution would last this long? Here's Peter Sagal and Rick Beeman from Constitution USA.
How long of you did they take? I'm curious about this because you've talked about, as we think about the founders, what did the founders think about us? Did they look at this country? They wanted to build a country that would last 100 years, 1,000 years. Did they think about that?
If someone had, you know, made a bet and said, this Constitution you're crafting will last 50 years, they'd say, not so sure about that. They would be astonished that it has lasted largely in the form in which they crafted it.
Really?
For 225 years.
But I guess what I'm saying is, wasn't that their intent? Didn't they want to craft a government that would last indefinitely? Or did they not know?
They had the humility to know that the union they were crafting was likely to be a fragile one, that it would almost certainly change as the country changed.
Right.
So they were creating a framework. But most important of all, they understood that this framework had to be a flexible framework.
That made me wonder, Peter, where you ended up in terms of the Founding Fathers, because it gets a little tiresome hearing them spoken about as, you know, on clouds.
Right.
Or even demonized on the other side. But I wondered you must have come away thinking, wow, they were really smart.
They were. As a matter of fact, in Rick Beeman's book, if Akhil Reed Amar is the preeminent legal scholar of the Constitution, Rick Beeman is the preeminent historian of the Constitution. Yeah. His book about the Constitutional Convention is called Plain, Honest Men. And that kind of sums it up. These were, in general, good guys. They were flawed. Many of them owned slaves. And one of the things you could talk about at great length is how what we call the Three-Fifths Compromise, that part of the Constitution that condoned slavery, pretty much doomed the country to civil war from the very beginning. But nonetheless, they had this vision, this crazy, radical, ideological vision that we would call like hippie-like in its naivete, that this vast country, again, from 1,000 miles, more than most people could ever travel in a lifetime, could govern itself according to a mechanism, simply relying on the goodwill of its own people. To trust people, and they had varying levels of trust. James Madison, it turns out, didn't have a lot of very nice things to say about the uneducated masses.
Right.
But the fact that they thought this could work was crazy. And an act of utopianism and faith in human nature that, you know, we had never seen before. To actually give power to all of you people with no education, many of you who can't read, many of you who've never left your farm, you get to govern yourselves, go for it, is just nuts in its just pure blue sky optimism. And whatever else you can say about them, whatever their failures, whatever cumbersome machinery they created with the Electoral College to make sure that those unwashed farmers didn't get too close to the levers of power, that act of faith in humanity is something you can't help but applaud them for. And I don't think we should admire them for their perfect wisdom. They weren't, you know, they weren't as they appear to be on the murals, the WPA era murals in the National Archives. They're not these godlike figures from Greek or Roman friezes. They're men. They screwed up. They personally and politically, they were wrong about stuff. But man, just for that act of faith, not only in their contemporaries, but in us, in their posterity, we should, at the very least, be grateful to them.
You come up with a really, what I thought was a brilliant analogy to sort of give us a sense of what it's like to interpret an ancient text for people.
Yes.
And that's your brother.
This is also in tonight's episode.
Yeah, it's in tonight's episode. We meet your brother. I want to play an excerpt here, but I think it's quite brilliant. This is his job. He's a rabbi.
Right.
And this is his job, is to interpret for a group of people, pretty decent-sized congregation in New Jersey.
Westfield.
This ancient document. Talk a little bit about that, because I want to play a little excerpt.
Well, I can't remember where this idea came up during the many conversations we had over meals. I'll take credit for it, since there's no one else here to argue with me. But this notion that there's a particular view of the Constitution, that it was given to us by these, you know, noble figures on that frieze, on that mural, 225 years ago, and our job is to interpret it and try to discern their meaning, you know, to sort of do close reading of the text, explication, as we used to say in English classes. Exegesis, as they say in religious classes, and just discern what they, these distant divine figures, want us to do. And it occurred to me that if that's how you're going to look at it, well, then, you know, go to any synagogue. A church will do, but I grew up in a synagogue, so I picked a synagogue. Because what they do in a synagogue is they take down these texts that were written, 2,000 years ago, more, 3,000 years ago, these ancient texts from a Bronze Age culture that talks about animal sacrifice and various other incredibly distant topics. And you take this text and then you translate it into modern terms. So, you know, if the text says, you know, you shall do no work on the Sabbath, well, what does that mean? Can you drive your car? And this is the job that rabbis in the Jewish tradition have and have had for 2,000 years, to figure this stuff out. So we talked to my brother about it, who has, on the one hand, these 3,000-year-old texts, and on the other hand, these 21st century modern suburban urban Jews living in New Jersey. How do you take Leviticus and its endless lists of animals and agricultural practice and booths in the field and apply it to some guy who works in Manhattan and drives a Lexus around to the mall on the weekend? And it's, you know, it's a similar problem. Well, let me ask you this then. So you're a rabbi.
Never thought I'd do it.
I know. Your job is to interpret this incredibly ancient text written on animal skin for 3,000 people who live in modern New Jersey.
Yeah.
And that's a full-time job, I know, and sometimes very stressful. Is there anything that you have learned doing this that you think you could offer as advice to those people who are out there trying to apply a 225-year-old document to life in these modern United States?
Well, my own view, and again, this is my view, is just like the Torah, the Constitution is a living document. And I believe, I could be wrong, that the founders intended it for it to be a living document, just as the Torah is a living document. You know, it was a very famous Talmudic story, right, about the rabbis who actually shout up to God and say, Lo b'shamayim hi, that'd be the Hebrew part. They say, it's no longer in heaven.
Yeah.
You've given the Torah to us. It's ours now to develop our life from it.
So there's a Talmudic story here. Let's come back around to a joke you tell.
You hear my voice getting more Jewish when I talk to him, by the way. I can hear that. It's very strange. All of a sudden, I'm talking like Woody Allen a little more than I normally do. But
well, I'll give you a chance to keep doing that because there's a Jewish joke you tell in episode one.
Oh, yes.
Which I think, I have to say, in some ways seems to be to characterize really what it is that our tradition is really all about. Not settling it, but doing something else. Will you tell that finally? Because I
will.
That's
and
really
I will
great.
Tell you this. That actually was one of the very first things we taped.
Huh.
Long before the whole journey began, we had one day of shooting, and I told this joke. And they were like, that's our theme. Here's the joke. And I will got it from my brother, and I will tell it. This is the one-minute version because we're close to the top of the hour.
Yeah.
So there's a synagogue, and they're having a big problem. They're having these big, big fights because of a single stupid argument, whether you should stand up or sit down during a certain prayer called the Shema. And everybody's angry, and they're constantly fighting, and it's spreading outside the synagogue, and people won't talk to each other, and it's terrible. And the rabbi doesn't know what to do, and he hears that there's an ancient member of the synagogue at age 110 who lives down at the Home for Aged Hebrews. So he goes down to consult him, and he says, Mr. Friedman, the guy's sitting there in the wheelchair, you know, he's blanket in his lap. He says, Mr. Friedman, you're the oldest member of our synagogue. You can clarify this. Is it the tradition in our synagogue to stand during the Shema to pay respect to God? And Mr. Friedman says, no, that's not the tradition. And he says, oh, Mr. Friedman, then the tradition in our synagogue must be that you sit during the Shema to show your humility before God. Mr. Friedman, eyes bleary, shakes his head and says, no, that's not the tradition. And the rabbi is gobsmacked. And he says, that's impossible, though, because we're constantly at each other's throats and we're fighting and people aren't talking to each other and there's threats and it's awful and we're constantly on the verge of splitting up entirely. And Mr. Friedman nods and says, that's the tradition. And that is, you know, that's us. That's America. You know, people look around and they see us constantly at each other's throats and decrying each other and swearing at each other and shouting at each other on cable TV. And they say, oh, there's something wrong with our country because we shouldn't be at each other's throats all the time. And that's the country. We've always had that country. I mean, we've always been angry at each other. We've always disagreed. We've always had regional and religious differences that have made us very furious. But with one very notable exception, we've settled those differences without bloodshed. And that means that the Constitution is working the way it's supposed to.
Peter Sagal, host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and the PBS series Constitution USA. The final episode airs tonight on PBS stations around the country. The first three episodes, by the way, are also available to watch online. Go to our website for the particulars about that. Peter Sagal, thank you very much for the time.
My pleasure, Doug. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.